Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to see you here. My name is Joe. I'm the pastor here at Rosalie Church, and it's great to be with you this morning. If you were alive this last week, you would have realised that there was a fairly significant decision that our nation made with regards to the same-sex marriage plebiscite. I sent in our church email newsletter just some reminders, I guess, for us on what is important as these big social changes happen in our society. I sent some reminders out. I just thought it would be good for those who aren't receiving the emails or can't get them for whatever reason, that I just go through a few of those truths for us again this morning. The first is that the gospel is no less powerful today than it was before the decision. The beliefs and opinions of humanity, in many ways, it's good that we live in a democratic society and our society can be free to express their opinions and nothing is enforced upon people. They've made their decision, but that doesn't stop God's decision. That doesn't stop God's power. And his decision was to send his son Jesus to save this world. And that's a pretty powerful thing he has done, far more powerful than any decision we or any government will ever make. Our area of Brisbane expressed 80% in support of same-sex marriage. That puts us in a significant minority, I reckon, maybe even outside in the area of Paddington here. It's probably even higher than that. But being in a minority doesn't mean that we should pull back from the world. It doesn't mean we should retreat from our involvement in our local community. As a church, over the last 5 years that I've been here, we have been constantly calling on one another to help one another out into the community that the message of Jesus Christ would thrust us towards the world in love. And that doesn't change. In fact, maybe it's more important than ever. Because there will be people, we believe that if we go against God's design for society, that things won't always go well for people. And there will be people hurt by this decision and hurt by the ramifications of any law change. And it has always been the grace of God in the church that has helped these people on the fringe who have been hurt by governments and their decisions. We need to be out amongst our people serving in love. We also have to lose well. Right at the beginning of the debate, I said that Christians will probably lose public debate more than we will win it. That's a reality that we have to face. And that possibly is because in all human standards, when Jesus came, our God came and lived here, he lost the public debate. The public shouted, "Crucify him." The government put him to death. And if we want to know how to lose in a Christ-like way, we just look at the way Jesus lost. He trusted in his Father's sovereignty. He was silent against his accusers. And all he expressed was love for those who hurt him. In the same way, we need to fight the temptation to respond with, retaliation or bitterness in any way. We need to make sure that, particularly on social media, we aren't doing anything that's inflammatory, bitter, or hurtful. And this is a place where a lot of that stuff often happens. I also want to affirm that the church here at Rosalie is here to support you in your mission to the world that you live in. We are a community. We don't just go out into the world as Robinson Crusoes, as, you know, heading out there by ourselves, have to deal it all on our own backs. The church here want to support one another. And so I want to gift you one another in that sense. Sit with someone and chat today about any difficulties you might have found this week as your workplace has discussed the decision. Chat with one another, support one another, pray for one another. Mention names of people in your life that you would love to minister through this time and share them in prayer with one another. And finally, I want to affirm the marriages of our church. I want to affirm marriage between a man and a woman as something given to us by God as a great gift. And your marriage is maybe even more important now than it ever has been, because marriage is given to us as a gift for us. It's beautiful, but it's also given as a witness to this world of the love of a God for his people. And so can I encourage you to invest in your marriages. Love your spouse well. Sacrifice for your spouse. And invite the world around you to see what your marriage has to witness to this world. And I'd also just like to say that as a church, our position will not change. The rites that I perform weddings under are the rites of the Baptist Union of Australia, which remain set in stone that marriage is between a man and a woman. So we as a church cannot perform same-sex unions. So that's where we stand as a church. Anyhow, let's come to God's Word this morning. We have been working through the book of Ecclesiastes over the last few weeks in our Wisdom Literature series, a series which we have called Every Good Path, as we've looked to see the good paths that God has prepared for us to walk in wisdom. I'm going to read to us this morning from Ecclesiastes chapter 9, the first 10 verses. So that is on page 557 of the Black Pew Bibles. If you have one of those, you're welcome to read along. Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and from verse 1. But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner. And he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in that all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil, and madness is in their hearts while they live. And after that, they go to the dead. But he who is joined with all the living has hope. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished. And forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun. Go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life and in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might. For there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. As Johnny has mentioned, it is often fairly grim, Ecclesiastes. It's said in Roman times, victorious generals were given a celebratory procession. You won a big battle for us, so we will treat you like God for a day. And this is literally what happened. Everything the general wanted, he got on that day. And as part of the celebrations, they would parade him through the city and bring him before the emperor, who would even pay him homage. Right at the height of the procession, however, right when the celebrations were at their peak, the lowliest of slaves was employed to stand behind the general and say to him, "Memento mori." Memento mori, Latin, means remember you will die. Right there at the height of his success, when he feels like he is a god on earth, a low slave is employed to tell him, don't forget, you're just a mortal man. You're just like the rest of us. For some reason, the Romans saw the value of reminding this general in the moment of his greatest success that he was just a man. That his present success would not stop his inevitable death. But this phrase, memento mori, actually became associated with a whole form of religious art, particularly in medieval Christianity. Basically, the deal was that people would paint or sculpt or create objects depicting death. And these were placed throughout churches. Sometimes even the bones of past believers were placed on display openly for all to see. It's a kind of far cry from the generic and non-confronting walls that most churches have today. But the reason behind the ghoulish art was simple. Memento mori. To remind churchgoers that they were not invincible. That it was important that they thought on their mortality and their desperate need for an immortal God. In Portugal, we actually went to a chapel where the walls and the structures inside the church were completely made out of and lined with the bones of past believers, past attenders of the church. And the doorway to the chapel was inscribed with a kind of ominous sign which said, in Portuguese obviously, "We bones that are here, for yours we await." Kind of chilling, hey? That you walk into church for the day and you are reminded that you will one day join the dry and dead bones on the wall. It's a very real reminder of a very real reality and a very certain destiny for us all. Now, while this is fairly morbid, it does seek to honour things like the book of Ecclesiastes. We've seen right throughout this series our examination of Solomon's journal of his search for meaning, that dwelling on some of the uglier parts of life, including death, is actually essential if we're to walk on the good paths that God has prepared for us to walk in. In fact, we've heard that it's better to dwell in the house of mourning than in the house of celebration. And so again this morning, our passage thrusts us towards the shocking and confronting reality of our own mortality. And as it does, we're going to wrestle with why it is vital to remember our mortality, why it is vital that we memento mori, that we remember we will die. And I hope that this will actually be quite practical for us, because as we will see, how we respond to the fact that one day we will die has far-reaching consequences for how we actually live. So let's get into it. For the last few weeks in this series, Solomon has wrestled with the complexity of a seemingly unfathomable nature to life. He could find no logic or reason or pattern that would help him grasp onto how life works. And this is why he calls life a vapor, a smoke, a cloud, something that looks solid, but when you try to grab it, it disappears. Something seemingly impossible to actually grab a hold of. The main reason for his confusion is the fact that there seems to be no consistency in how things play out in life. The good path of wisdom doesn't always lead to success. Sometimes it leads to tragedy. Sometimes it leads to suffering. And that wicked path of rebellion doesn't always lead to failure. Sometimes the people who walk that path seem to be the most successful people in our world. And as we move into chapter 9, Solomon continues to reflect on this confusing reality. In fact, he says that he lays it all to heart. Look at verse 1 of chapter 9. "But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him. There's a righteous man. His fate is in the hands of God. He doesn't know whether he's going to get lovely things or hateful things, good things or bad things. He does not know. Both are very real options, and there seems to be no logic as to why he gets one and not the other. And he goes on to say, it's the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. Not only has Solomon been confused by the seemingly random outcome of life for both the righteous and the wicked, he's completely stumped by the cold, hard reality that in the end, life is the same for everyone. Wicked or righteous, good or evil, clean or unclean, worshipper or non-worshipper, good or sinner, those with integrity, those without integrity, the same event happens to them all. And that event is death. Life ends the same way for everyone. It might look different, might happen in a different way, but it ends in the same destination, death. The most righteous person and the most wicked person, they both die. Solomon calls this a great evil. A great evil. And I reckon every one of us in this room this morning knows of that great evil. Evil here is not defined as something that is morally wrong, but rather something that goes against the beautiful order of creation as God intended it to be. And make no mistake, death is not a part of God's created plan. God did not create us to die. See, it's easy to downplay the tragedy of death because we hear about death all the time. We watch reports of mass deaths caused by famine, disease, and war, and we see them on the news almost every single day. We see it dramatized for us in movies, and we even become virtual killers ourselves as we take aim on video games. In some ways, we have been desensitized to death and desensitized to just how wrong it actually is. But this morning, Solomon wants us to reflect on the reality that everyone will die, and he wants us to reflect especially on the reality that this is completely wrong. Death is wrong. Whether it's the miscarried or stillborn child, the middle-aged man who has a heart attack, the toddler with inoperable cancer, the teenage girl killed in a car crash, the teenage boy who takes his own life, or the elderly woman who passes peacefully in her sleep, death hurts. It does not matter how expected or unexpected, how young or how old, how deserving or undeserving. Everything about death feels completely wrong. Solomon tells us in verse 4, "But he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion." A dog in this context is not my Sally next door, a cute little puppy, a nice domesticated pet, but considered to be a kind of cursed animal, a wild scavenger that actually served no purpose but to clean up the scraps of this world. But Solomon says, better that you are a cursed, despised scavenger dog who is alive than a glorious, powerful, fearsome lion who is dead. Why? Verse 5, "For the living know they will die, but the dead know nothing. And they have no more reward, for for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is done under the sun. Death is a separator. Death separates us from those we love. And it separates those we love from the joys of this life. Everything we hoped that we would get to share with them is gone. Everything we hoped that they would get to see, to taste, to feel is gone. Everything we longed to see them achieve is gone. It is relatively easy to be desensitized to death right up until the point that death enters into our personal space and inflicts pain upon someone close to us. And I know that many of you here this morning have been gripped by this pain, that you have experienced the loss, the separation from someone that you love, some of you more recently than others. I've seen some of you walk that journey of pain. I've walked that journey alongside some of you. So I know how wrong death is. I think we all know how painfully wrong death is. And so you might be sitting here this morning and thinking to yourself, well, Joe, if you know how wrong death is, why are you causing us to dwell on it once again? Why dredge up the pain of death when we were trying to forget, when we were trying to move on? Well, here's the deal. By causing us to focus on just how wrong death is, Solomon is doing something for us that this world rarely does for us. He's given us permission to actually grieve. In so many cases, the world tells us that we need to be strong in our mourning, that we need to put on a brave face, that we need to celebrate what was good about the person we have lost and get on with our lives, because that is what that person would have wanted. Even in the church, we sometimes spiritualize this. We give the impression that to grieve too much, we are showing a lack of faith, or that we've clung too tightly to an earthly relationship, that we have no trust in God. And so we think we have to be strong, and we have to suppress our grief. But Solomon this morning has vindicated the grief you have felt, the feelings of separation, of hurt, of loss, of bitter disappointment. We don't grieve death because we are weak. We don't grieve death because we have clung too tightly to something earthly. We don't grieve death because we lack faith. We grieve death because it's the right response to death, because death is wrong. It's not wrong to mourn. It's not wrong to grieve. It's not faithless to lament. In fact, sometimes these are the only faithful response that we can make to the sting and the wrongness of death. Sure, as believers, our grief is not supposed to destroy us. It's not supposed to go on and on. It's not supposed to crush us completely. But we are supposed to grieve because death is wrong. Solomon calls it a great evil. Nothing anyone can do or say can make death right. The reason that it's vital this morning and in our lives that we dwell on the wrongness of death is so that we can know just how wrong it is and let that vindicate our grief. So if you encounter death in your life somewhere, someone close to you, a loved one passes, do not bottle up your grief. Do not put on a facade of supposed strong faith. Let your faith in God remind you that death is not what he made us for. Let it give you permission to grieve well, to grieve for that person. This also helps us in how we counsel a friend who has lost a loved one. I reckon it's the time in life we know what to say the least. We have nothing to say. In fact, we might actually feel awkward and not want to go and be with that person because we feel like, I've got no words, I've got nothing to say. You can simply sit with them. Reflect on the wrongness of death. Reflect on the pain of separation and weep with them. Just grieve with them. Just be with them. If you have to say anything, vindicate their grief. Tell them it is okay to grieve. In fact, their grief reflects on the fact they actually cared and loved this person. That they feel pain because the death and the separation are wrong and will always feel wrong. I told you I hoped this would be practical this morning. Let this be a practical truth for us in our grief and us in how we help others grieve. Let us vindicate one another's grief. Let us walk alongside one another in grief. And let us remind one another that no matter how much we see it, how much we get desensitized to it, death is always wrong. I did mention that I hope this morning would be practical, and I believe this is the case because there are two possible ways that we can respond to the reality that death awaits us all and that death is tragically wrong. The first is the way of Bon Jovi. Yep, that now aging glamour rocker from the 80s and 90s told us this. Until I'm 6 feet under, baby, I don't need a bed. I'm going to live while I'm alive and sleep when I'm dead. That's right. Mr. John Bon Jovi understands that death is coming. He understands that death cuts him off from the land of the living, that his opportunity to experience life will be stripped from him. So he decides that now is the time to really live, to get after everything that he wants. And in the song, it's most likely a woman that he wants. And in the short time that he has, he wants to get it all. Our generation these days call Bon Jovi's sentiment YOLO. You only live once. YOLO means that you might as well spend all of your time, your energy, your money, your resources chasing down your dreams because it's too late to chase a dream when you are dead, when you are gone. What this has created, however, is a generation of people with an insatiable need to conquer everything as quick as we possibly can. Because we have so many dreams. We have so many things we want to do. Old age and death, they're just round the corner. So we need to do it all now. We want to get everything faster than it's even possible to actually get it. We want education, we want career, money, travel, friends, lust, love, family, success. And we can never get it quick enough. And the problem is that we're creating an unsustainable dream. The ideal of YOLO looks like liberation. I'm free to risk everything to trace after my dreams, but it's actually a back-breaking slavery. A back-breaking slavery for two reasons. One, because we are enslaved to an extreme case of buyer's regret. You know buyer's regret? When you go out and you make that expensive purchase and you get it home and you start to play with it and you realize this doesn't solve all my life's problems. This doesn't do everything I hoped it would do. I don't really feel satisfied by it. Maybe then you look on Facebook and you see someone else who's got something better and you're like, oh, should have got that one. Maybe in a restaurant you order a meal, you're tossing up between two and you get one, it comes out, looks pretty disappointing. And the other person at the table ordered the thing you were, other thing you want, it looks amazing and you're like, oh, man, should have ordered that one. Well, we feel that regret every time we reach one of our dreams. because we never ever give ourselves the chance to enjoy it, because it never lives up to our expectations. And we only spend 5 minutes on Facebook to see others whose dreams seem so much better than ours, and suddenly we're gripped by the need to get out there and YOLO again. So instead of being free, YOLO traps us into chasing after more and more dreams, never really giving us the satisfaction. We all become kind of like Jarryd Hayne, you know, that footballer? Chases after his dreams. Oh, I dream to be an NRL player. I dream to be an NFL player. I dream to play rugby at the Olympics. So many dreams, chasing after them all. We all become just like him. He's got kind of a laughing stock at the moment. We're that laughing stock as we chase after dream after dream after dream. The second thing we get enslaved to is the fear of failure. If we place so much currency in achieving our dreams, then we'll be crushed if we don't actually make it. One by one, our dreams go up in smoke, and instead of feeling the buzz of success, we feel the bitter sting of failure. And because we only have one life, we've stuffed up our one life completely. Living for you is all about success. And you only get one chance to do it. One chance to do it right. So instead of liberating us to enjoy our lives, YOLO traps us under the weight of expectation and the pressure to get our lives right. You better win, because you've only got one chance to do it. See, my fear for us as a generation is that we will be crushed by what we think sets us free. In recognizing the certainty of death, many of us have simply decided to get as much as we can in a short amount of time as we can get it. And I believe it is slowly choking us. I remember talking with a young man who explains perfectly how this not only crushes us in life, but has the potential to bankrupt our faith. He was in the process of walking away from Jesus, walking away from his faith. He was wrestling whether he should cling to Jesus or not. And as we chatted through all the issues, when it came to the end, he said, "Joe, I just don't want to be alone. I just don't ever want to be alone. I don't want to die lonely." His greatest fear was that by staying in the church, by continuing to follow Jesus, he would have to embrace the relationship ethic that Jesus taught. He knew that. And he knew that that might mean him being celibate for life, him missing out on enjoying the pleasures of romantic relationship, of sex and everything it had to offer. And he did not want to give that up, no matter what. And so he walked away from Jesus in pursuit of not dying lonely. And it breaks my heart to say it, but he's no closer to relationship intimacy today than the day that he walked away. He's probably further away. Can I plead with you this morning? If this is you, if there is something that is either holding you back from embracing Jesus or sowing seeds of doubt in your heart about remaining in Jesus, then you need to know that you will never be free. You'll never truly be free if you free yourself from Jesus. You will never be free. You're subscribing to YOLO and getting everything you can in the shortest amount of time possible, and yet it just crushes us under buyer's regret and under the fear of failure. You'll never be free if you free yourself from Jesus. Can I instead plead with you to listen to the words of Solomon in verses 7 through 10? "Go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart. For God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love, or the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun. because that is your portion in life and your toil at which you toil at under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going." This is how Solomon calls us to respond to the certainty of our death. Now, on the surface, it actually seems a little bit like YOLO. A little bit like just embrace life. Enjoy food and wine and enjoy marriage. Enjoy your work. Just go out there and get it. It seems a little bit hedonistic. Enjoy bread, wine, fine garments, good complexion, relationships, work. But listen carefully to how Solomon frames all of this. Eat your bread. Drink your wine. Let your garments be white. Put oil on your head. Enjoy the wife you love. The overwhelming thrust of this passage is not to go out seeking new dreams, new pleasures, new prosperity, but rather to look at what you've actually been given by God, no matter how great or small, no matter how good or bad you think it is, and to be satisfied with it. To joyously eat however much bread you've been given to eat. To let whatever brand of wine you have make your heart merry. If you have a $5 bottle from the bottom shelf, enjoy it. If you've got a $60 bottle from probably the second top shelf, enjoy it. Clean whatever garments you have so you're not moping around looking dirty and filthy and ragged. Make sure your hair and face are glowing. That's the oil thing. You know, most people try and get oil out of their hair today. I don't know why. I've got lovely, nice, oily hair. No product needed. Good Pakistani jeans. Put oil in your hair and on your face. Let your complexion shine regardless of your situation. Enjoy life with your covenant wife. Don't go seeking enjoyment in other relationships with other women. Make the most of whatever job you are currently working in. Enjoy it. Be satisfied with it. Don't always be looking for the next promotion. Now, this doesn't mean that you should never be ambitious, but rather it frames why sometimes we can be ambitious. You should not be seeking more for yourself in order to satisfy yourself, because you should already be satisfied with what you have. Within reason, it's okay to seek something new, but that ambition should be driven by a desire to give more of yourself to something new, not to gain something more satisfying for yourself. Solomon's answer to the certainty of death is not YOLO. So now's your chance to get as much as you can for yourself, but YOLO. So now that is the time to be content with what you have. Think about it. You only have one life. So why waste it pursuing someone else's life? You've been given the life you have. Find contentment there, and you are free from the pressure of chasing down dreams that will probably never be. Or at the very least, even if they come to fruition, dreams that will never truly satisfy you. So here's the very practical choice that all of us face when we are confronted with the certainty of our death. Do I take my one life and spend every moment chasing down another dream? Or do I take my one life and look at what I've been given in rest, in satisfaction in what God has given me? One will lead to a painful life of slavery and disappointment and unrest. The other to a restful contentment and joy. But in closing this morning, I want to suggest that there is one thing more than anything else that keeps us from truly finding this contentment and truly being satisfied with what we have been given. And it's the fact that so many of us have this nagging voice in the back of our heads that says, "Memento mori." It's almost like that lowly slave follows us around and his refrain strikes fear into our hearts. That we are petrified of the fact that we will die. That it is our greatest fear, the fear above all other fears, that we will die and things we hope to accomplish will be left unfinished. People we long to be closer to will remain at a distance. Successes will never be realized. That voice, memento mori, is like a chill down our spine, gripping us with fear. Everything that Solomon has said about death resonates with us. We feel the weight of its sting. We fear death. And that stops us from truly living. Solomon has struggled to understand the vapor of life, mainly because he's missing one stunning revelation of God. A revelation that we have unhindered access to. Solomon knew death was his great enemy, but he did not know that that enemy was going to be defeated. When Jesus Christ came and embraced our life, he became human flesh. He became a fetus inside his mother. He grew and his mother gave birth to him. He lived every ounce of what it means to live life. And you know what? He lived that life as a mortal. He lived that life in mortal flesh. Jesus embraced our lot. Where Solomon says, the righteous man and the wicked man, the same event happens to both. The same event happened to Jesus. Jesus did not take a half effort at being human. He embraced everything that it meant to be human. Even death hanging over his head. When Jesus Christ came and embraced our life, he also embraced our death. And Jesus embraced the sting of death, probably a greater sting of death than anyone before him or anyone to come after him. The innocent, immortal God suffered the fate of a mortal and a cruel death at that. And yet, Jesus did something that no other mortal had ever done. Jesus defeated death. Jesus rose from the grave in the power of God the Father, in the power of the Holy Spirit. Jesus was raised triumphantly from the grave. So Paul can mock death. Death, where is your sting? Where is your victory? It is gone. Jesus, in his resurrection, has conquered death. And so, yes, there should be a voice that whispers into our ear, memento mori, remember you will die. But it should not instill fear in our hearts. It should not crush us. It should not force us into a life of slavery to YOLO. It should set us free to be content with what God has given us now, and have an unwavering and undefeatable hope for our future. That there is a life beyond death for those who trust in Jesus, because Jesus has defeated death. Let's pray. Father, it is grim and grave for us to reflect on the reality every single one of us in this room will die. From the youngest to the oldest. death is inescapable. And we know that it is painful. We know that it is wrong. We know that when you formed this world and when you formed us, humanity, Adam and Eve, that you did not form us for death. You created us for eternity. You created us for life. And we know that it is our sin that has brought death into this world. And we know how wrong that is. Help us to be a community that grieves well, Lord. It doesn't try and bottle it up or pretend that we need to be strong or faithful. Let our faith as a community help us grieve well. Let it vindicate our grief and help us to help one another feel vindicated in our grief over death. Help us to grieve with one another well. And more than anything, Lord, set us free from the slavery of trying to get as much as we possibly can in this life for ourselves. Help us to be content, regardless of how good or how bad our lot in life is. Help us to be content in the knowledge that your Son Jesus has defeated death, and a life awaits us, a life as you intended it to be, a life completely free from the fear of death, a place where there will be no mourning, no sadness, no sickness, no weakness, no death, a place of eternal and everlasting life. Thank you, Lord, for defeating death for us. Thank you for conquering our greatest fear. And help us to live lives that reflect that reality.